We are finishing up the topic from week two and then moving into week three. So the topic last week was mysticism and Torah study. And we began by noting that Torah study in Judaism is supposed to be verbal. It's supposed to be a conversation. And so really what we're talking about, when we talk about the mysticism of and Kabbalah of Torah study, what we're really talking about is the power of speech and the way that speech can be used in different ways. And in particular, we're focused on the speech involved in study. But in order to understand the mystical view of what's happening when people are learning Torah, you first have to understand what is happening when people are speaking and working our way backward. Therefore, we needed to really start with a conversation about why we are here in the universe, what it is that human beings are doing in the world altogether. And so we had this idea of the universe being constructed of layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. We talked about it last time. I'm not going to reopen that whole discussion, but we said that there are realms that are more spiritual, and then there are realms that are more material. And as the mystics see it, these realms are tied together by effectively human beings. What we do in the realm of action, in the realm of speech, in the realm of thought, affects all of these realms and repairs them. It improves them. There is a need for these realms to be made whole. Why they need to be made whole is beyond what we're going to be discussing in this session. But there is a need for them to be improved and for the connections between them to be strengthened such that divine influence will come down to this world. And therefore, when we use our speech, our powers of action, and even our thoughts in positive ways, we are actually enabling the universe as a whole to be able to receive divine benefit. It's a radically different view from the view that says, my list of mitzvot are simply the things that God told me do and don't do. And therefore, if I do the things I'm supposed to do, I get a check mark. And if I don't do the things I'm supposed to do, then I'm going to get an X. And it's about my track record as a Jew. This is an entirely different way to look at things. And it says what's really going on is that these actions are affecting the universe as a whole, and speech in particular plays a role in this. I brought you on the sheet sources 1 and 2. Anyone who doesn't have the sheets, they're over there on the table. The sources 1 and 2 are sources we looked at in the beginning of the session last time. But to refresh our memories, we said from the Zohar, even the breath of the mouth has a place and position. God does with it what he does, meaning even your breath has significance. Even a person's word, even a person's voice is not for nothing. All have a place and position. Everything has significance. And then we saw 2, every word that a person produces from his mouth ascends upward and pierces heavens and enters the place above. But it's not only that whatever you do is significant, whether it's your speech, whether it's your actions, whether it's your thoughts. That's true, but speech is uniquely significant. Why would speech be more important than thoughts? Why would speech be more important than deeds?
Because another person can hear them?
Because another person can hear them. Well, actions also impact on others, though. It's more than that. That's a piece of it.
Can't take back what you've said?
Can't take back what you've said, but the same thing could be true for deeds. Because speech is something that we associate specifically with human beings as opposed to other creatures, right? The ability to communicate abstract ideas. All creatures communicate on one level or another, but the ability to take abstract ideas and communicate them to others verbally is something that we understand to be uniquely human. So maybe that could be an element of it. So God spoke to us, and therefore we have a sense of emulation of God. In fact, the world is created via speech. That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that in association with this, but I think Judith's point is well taken, that it's a divine... Right. The well, that speech because it's going to have to be.
It's still speech. Yeah. It's still the value of speech.
Right. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin suggests, and I brought you a piece of it in number three, but it's actually not the full point. He suggests that speech combines the efforts of the three parts of the soul. In other words, that which goes into speech, that which goes into thought, that which goes into deed, reflect different aspects of the soul. We talked about that last time, nefesh, ruach, and neshama. And when you speak, you're combining all three components, which makes sense, right? Just before we get to the mystical aspect of it, speech is a deed, right? It isn't just emerging. You have to produce the sounds. And ideally, you think before you speak, right? I'm experimenting with that these days. It works. It's really working well for me. The idea that it also involves thought. But take a look at number three, where Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin takes us even further. He says, each word has three aspects, speech, thought, and deed, nefesh, ruach, and neshama, which are the letters, vowels, and ta'amim of the word. And he quotes you the work Tikkuni Zohar to say that ta'amim are the neshama. What are ta'amim? Anybody know?
Taste.
Well, literally, we use ta'am to mean taste, but yeah?
The
not the vowels, the trop. Good. Yeah. The ta'amim are what are colloquially termed the trop or the cantillation notes. The musical notes that we use when we read from the Torah or tonight from the Megillah, right? That's the neshama. That's the soul of the word. And we'll talk about that more in a moment. But he says the ta'amim are the neshama. That's the soul of it. The vowels are the ruach. And the letters are the nefesh. So the letters being the nefesh is relatively straightforward because nefesh, we said, is the most material aspect of a person's soul. That's the letter. So it's the sort of hard physical thing. The vowels, the vowels are associated with the ruach. Ruach is what we said is associated with speech. And that makes sense because if you don't have vowels, you can't pronounce words. Right? It doesn't work. Right? Try pronouncing the word beged. Right? Without vowels. You're not going to get very far. Well, that's pure vowels. Right. What do you mean? Vowels in Hebrew, let's be clear. Vowels in Hebrew are what we often think of as the dots, because that's what we use to signify them. So it absolutely does. Sure it does. It absolutely does. It depends on which way you are using it. Meaning, sometimes you will find it pronounced Adonai, right? In which case, you will have a chataf patach under the yud, right? And you will have an acholam, you'll have an o, and then you'll have a kamatz. In other words, the vowels that make that word, whatever, however you're going to say it, including if you were going to use the pronunciation that we don't ever use, but it has vowels.
Yeah.
It's just that we don't say the name. But that's... The Torah does not have vowels written into it. Let me make this clear, because maybe this is where people are getting stuck. The system that we have, in which we put dots under a word, over a word, in order to show how the word should be pronounced, is relatively late. I believe it's 9th or 10th century. That's how long it took to come up with a system in which you're going to actually have dots that everybody is able to parse in order to understand how to pronounce the word. Until then, you knew what the pronunciation was without having dots written for you, much as when you get up to read from the Torah, there are no dots in a Sefer Torah, right? You're saying it because you've learned the words and you know them. So when I say that it's the vowels, I mean the vowels themselves. I don't mean the dots that are used to signify them. That's what we're talking about. And it's what gives the letters life.
You mean the vowel sounds.
The vowel sounds, correct. Okay. And then the ta'amim, the notes, are the neshama, which is the most ethereal of the souls, the most pure of the souls. The notes often tell us what the word means. They often add to the way a sentence should be read, meaning it isn't just these are nice sounds that make the Torah reading more enjoyable, but they actually tell us how to break up sentences. It can change the meaning of a passage in terms of where you put your pause, where you put your break. And you see that over and over again in Tanakh. Yes, it is exactly punctuation. It just happens to sound a lot better than, you know, question mark and exclamation point.
Well, commas right. are important, too. In the
commas are important, too. We believe in commas. They
they break up the sentence and change the meaning.
Yes. So what we're getting at here, what he's trying to tell you is there are different aspects of speech. There is the deed aspect of speech, the letter itself. There is the speech aspect of speech, if you will, which is the vowel, but then there's also the meaning behind it, and that corresponds with the thought that you invest in it. So speech he views as representing all of the different aspects of human activity, and and in Judaism in general, we see that kind of power in speech, right? Think of the fact that, biblically, right, Hashem says to Avraham, Et asher tevarech mevorach, Vasher ta'or you are. Whoever you bless will be blessed. Whoever you curse will be cursed. The idea that a human being could articulate a wish for something to befall somebody else, good or bad, and it will come true, tells you that the Torah is not looking at speech as just whatever comes out of your mouth, but as something with real significance, with real impact. The idea that Bilam wants to come curse the Jews, and God says, I'm going to reverse it, so everything he says comes out as a blessing. Tell me, there would be a lot easier way for God to deal with Bilam, right? He doesn't have to go through the whole game of converting his curses into blessings. What could God have done instead?
Strike him.
Leave aside, strike him down. Let's say God's not in the mood to strike people down today.
Just make it not effective.
Yeah, just don't listen to him. You're God. Who cares what Bilam says? Right? Why does Bilam's curse matter? But the answer is that human speech has significance. The things you say are not only about social convention, the way we interpret words and the weight that we assign them. They have real impact and real meaning, and that's that's what's being stressed here in these sources. Yes, Ricky.
They start wars. They start quarrels. They change people's feelings about for good or for worse.
All true. But all of that is on a human level.
That's a basic.
That's all the way we choose to respond to people's speech or not respond, as the case may be. What this is saying is there's a universal impact that has nothing to do with what human beings decide or don't decide. It's an automatic impact. And therefore, if you take a look at number 4, we jumped ahead to this last week, but now we'll see it in context. We find this midrash, which gets quoted in a variety of places and in a variety of different ways, talking about the Navi Amos, Prophet Amos, who said, describing God, the former of mountains, the creator of the wind, who tells a person his speech, Magid la Adam Masecho, that God tells people their speech. So the Midrash here is bothered. What does that mean, that God tells people their speech? So the Midrash explains, this is a reference to God's praise and might. When God decides to create a person, he decrees how many conversations that person will have, how many things he will say. As David said, for there is no word on my tongue, God, you know all of it. That is scary. Sure you do. Just choose which words you will say. And when you reach your limit, you're done. That's the idea. It's really a scary idea, no? Because you don't know what you were assigned, you never really know, right? I threw out the idea last week that maybe words that are used for holy purposes don't count towards your total. Maybe this is only like junk words, you know? I don't know.
The less you say, the better. The fewer words you use, the longer time you have to say.
So what this doesn't say, what I want to make sure to note, what this does not say is, and when a person has used up all their words, then they die. That I've heard people say that. That's not here. That's not in this midrash. They may just be quieter. But this is true. This empowers positive speech, and it also empowers harmful speech. If you take a look at source number 5, it addresses Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is?
Gossip.
Not so much.
Not
harmful speech. Harmful speech. Not necessarily slander. That's a legal term. There are three different terms in Judaism there are more than that, but there are three that we're going to focus on for speech that is prohibited. There is Lashon Hara, which is true speech that is negative about somebody. Okay, when it's true, when someone says to you, but it was true, the answer is yes, that's what makes it Lashon Hara. If it's false, it's called Motzi Shem Ra, which means giving a person a bad reputation. And then the third one, the one that people have the most trouble with, is Rechilut, which is tail-bearing. Which is, I'm not saying anything negative about somebody. And what I'm saying isn't harmful. And what I'm saying is true. And guess what? It's still prohibited. You're not supposed to go around telling people about what's going on in other people's lives. That's called Rechilut. That's what gossip is. So all of the above. So take a look at source number 5, what the Zohar says about Lashon Hara, harmful speech. There is a spirit that stands over the speakers of Lashon Hara. When people catalyze Lashon Hara, then that evil, impure spirit above is awakened. And it rests on that activity of Lashon Hara in which people are involved, and it rises and causes death and murder in the world through the energy of that Lashon Hara. Woe to those who arouse that evil spirit and don't guide their mouths and tongues and are not worried about this and don't know that the arousal above is dependent upon a catalyst below, whether for good or bad. Wow. Wasn't you? Okay. But that's the level of concern that the mystics have for what happens when people talk. But onto the positive side of it, the mitzvah of Torah study. If you look at number 6, also from the Zohar, when a person produces a holy declaration from his mouth, a declaration of Torah, right, like we're doing, a voice is produced from it, and it ascends above and arouses the holy ones of the highest king, meaning the malachim, the angels, and it is crowned, and it causes great joy in the realms above and below. The speech, when a person uses their speech for Torah, then it actually causes joy in the heavens, joy in all of these realms that are now connected through the person having used their speech in a positive way. Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin, similarly, in source number 7, since the time of the destruction of the temple and the exile of the children from their father's table, the Shekhinah, manifestation of God, wanders, as it were, and cannot find rest. The only thing that remains is the Torah. When the Jews, holy nation, speak appropriate words of Torah, they become a mini-temple for the Shekhinah. As it is written, from the day when the temple was destroyed, God has nothing in his world other than the 4 cubits of Jewish law, which is a quote from the Talmud. So the impact here is to make the world a home for God. Yes, Ricky.
Is that dependent on kavanah, on intention, on sincerity of the speech, or is that can be just any?
That's a really good question. And you can answer that in two different ways. The Talmud has a line from a sage by the name of Rava, if I remember correctly. He says in the Aramaic, "La'olam ligris inish, va'af agav demashkach, va'af agav delo yada maika omar." He says, a person should always be gores. Gores is a term that's used to refer not really to study, but to speaking words of a text. A girsa is the addition of a text. So it just means a person should always say the words of Torah, even if he's going to forget it, and even if he doesn't know what he's saying. There is value in saying the words, even without comprehending. So that's on one level. On the other hand, the mystics are heavily invested in the idea of kavanot, of intentions, of before you do a mitzvah, reciting a passage that focuses you on what it is that you're trying to accomplish with it. because of this point, because of the power that it has. I think everybody agrees, rationalist and mystic alike, that intent is important. But the mystic is going to place a lot more emphasis on it. The rationalist is going to say, God told you to do this mitzvah, and you did it. God said, light Shabbat candles. Okay, I lit Shabbat candles. Whether I thought about creating honor and dignity and beauty for the day, or whether it was just what this is what I do at whatever time, you know, the synagogue bulletin tells me to, at the end of the day, you did the mitzvah. Whereas the mystic is going to say, yeah, but you're not just checking off what you did. You're also impacting the universe. And therefore, the thought that you invest in it matters. So, yeah, there's a lot to say between those two poles. But yes, the thought will be significant from a mystical perspective.
So,
yeah.
When people daven, they just daven really quickly. I sit there and I look at every word. I speak Hebrew, so it's a big difference. But people don't speak Hebrew, and they know what they're right. saying. But still, there's a lot of... Blah, 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 blah. How could they possibly internalize all the beautiful words?
So davening, prayer, is a thing unto itself. Meaning, it's the category of mitzvah, which is not only an action, but it's also, by definition, a communication. You're supposed to be saying something to God, something of meaning. And therefore, to pray without thought, to pray without knowing what you're saying and without thinking about what you're saying, it's not the same thing as lighting a Shabbat candle without thinking about why you're doing it. It's much worse. Because where is the meaning? Where is the thought? Where's the emotion? Now, I have to say, one should not assume that other people are really not thinking. Could be that people just are really good at coming in with an agenda, knowing what they want to say to God. They know the words already, and therefore they are really able to convey those thoughts quicker than I can. I daven with people who are just that, they're just that much better at it than I am. I'm not saying that sarcastically, I'm saying that sincerely. The truth of the matter is that I believe the best route to be able to daven well, to pray well, is to daven before you daven. No, seriously. Meaning, come in knowing what you want to talk about. Come in knowing what you want to say. You'll do much better than if you're trying to invent it on the fly, saying words that are in a language that's not your native tongue. Now, I do believe that people also should use their native tongue, right? Halacha says that other than for the Shema, there's no reason for you to be speaking it in a language that you don't understand. Shema is unique because it's very hard to translate Shema properly. But other than that, say it in the language you understand. But even still, you have to come in with an agenda, right? If a person comes in, I had a board member who, back when I was a shul rabbi, who said something that I thought made a lot of sense. He got it off of Intel, you know, Intel the company. That at one point, a board member gave an interview talking about why the company was so successful. I don't know if they're still so successful, but at the time, they really were. And one of the things that he said was they have a rule. You don't show up to a meeting unless there is a written agenda. If you're invited to a meeting, but there's no agenda disseminated beforehand, don't go. It's simple and it's brilliant, right? Because if people come in not knowing what they're going to be talking about, they're not ready. They're wasting your time and you're wasting their time. Come in knowing what it is that you want to say. The committees have to have done their work. Everybody has read the report, hopefully, before the meeting. You don't want to hand out stuff at a meeting and have people sit there reading, or worse, have someone read aloud the written report that they should have sent out before the meeting. Come in knowing what you want to discuss, and then you'll have a proper conversation. The same thing is true when you want to daven, right? If you run in at the last minute, or worse, half an hour after it started, right? And now you're going to just start thinking about what it is that you want to say, you're so far behind. How in the world is that going to happen? So that's my rant. Coming back, though, to where we were.
It's a big one for a lot of people.
Good. So thank you for asking about that. The phrase that he used here in number 7, that he quoted from the Talmud, Rabbi Chaim of Elazar quotes it from the Talmud, that since the temple was destroyed, God has nothing in his world other than Arba Amot Shel Halacha, the 4 cubits of Jewish law. So 4 cubits is a term that's used Talmudically to refer to the space occupied by a human being. So the place where you practice the Torah is the 4 cubits of Jewish law. 4 cubits, there's some debate, as always, why not, as to how long a cubit is. A comedian who has since been disgraced had a routine where he asked, you know, he envisioned Noah asking God, what's a cubit? But the general assumption is that it is somewhere between a foot and a half and 2 feet. Is a cubit. So the space a person occupies is said to be their 4 cubits. So it's where we practice the Torah. Yes, exactly that. The prohibition on Shabbat, I'm not allowed to transport things 4 cubits in the public domain, because then I'm moving it out of the space where it had been. The space it occupied was this 4 cubit area. It's all of the same. It's all the same piece. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry.
Except when there is an eruv.
Right. Right. Not. That's what I said, through a public area. The eruv converts it to not be a public area. Okay. So, yes.
When you say the space a person occupies, meaning with their whole body?
No, I mean the area around them. You are not 4 cubits tall. What we mean is the area around you. You are in a space called your. It's a phrase even in contempt.
More space than the small person.
Understood. No one's ever taking more than 4 amot. The 1 amma is a foot and a half to 2 feet. But it's a phrase. It's colloquialism. Even you can hear it. Not in all circles necessarily, but someone says that person was in my 4 amos. It means that person was in my personal space.
Yeah. It only means, while in Shul or anywhere, if we're spiritual beings and we can be spiritual actions, wouldn't it be anywhere we go?
Or absolutely. No, anywhere we go.
Anywhere. So it's the speech, it's everything.
Yes, right. Absolutely. Others? Okay, so then to sum up what we did with this section, we talked about the view of Kabbalah more globally. We are here in order to improve the universe on a metaphysical level, aside from the practical tikkun olam type of idea. But on a metaphysical level, we are here to make the universe a place that can receive divine influence, and we do it through thought, speech, deed. And our Torah study is part of that process and brings that purification into this world. There's more to be said, but I want to make sure to start on our third topic. So I'm going to